Welcome, Dan, to another edition of Brewmaster Spotlight here with thefullpint.com from New Glarus Brewing, New Glarus, Wisconsin.
Hi, good morning.
Glad you could make it today. So, want to start off by getting your story on the new R&D series that's been the buzz.
Well, you know, we hired a new lab manager, Randy Thiel, who used to be brewmaster at the Ohm Gang Brewery in Cooperstown, New York. And he's been on board for a little over a year. And we were thinking about, you know, fun projects and things that might be interesting for our customers. And we were looking at trying to maybe explore different flavors and different ways of brewing to try to help us to, improve our process, improve the way we make beer, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of where the R&D series came from. So R&D, of course, means research and development, but it also means Randy and Dan. So we collaborate on these beers that maybe are not really particularly marketable beers, maybe something that we would sell a lot of, but nonetheless are a lot of fun to brew and are very educational. And then we decided that since we sell so many beers, we might sell 16 or 18 beers in a year, that we were starting to overrun our wholesalers. And it's difficult for them to manage so many brands. And frankly, when you start making these sort of esoteric beers, it's hard for them to really understand what you're doing. So we said, you know, we're just going to sell it out of our gift shop, because we have a fairly large gift shop and we do pretty well there. And we thought that we could sort of hand sell it.
So I guess you guys weren't subject to any kind of a three-tier political mess in your region where you had to go through another channel.
Well, I believe in the state of Wisconsin you can self-distribute, but all of our beer is sold through the three-tier system. And we're a big fan of the three-tier system. We think it works. But in this case, since we're selling the beer only out of our gift shop, and we're licensed to do that, we don't go through the three-tier system on these beers. And it's just simply, as I said, because it gets too confusing. You know, when you hit a wholesaler with a lambic beer and try to explain it to them and how you're going to sell it, it becomes a little bit confusing. And more importantly, it takes their energy away from what pays the bills. It's sort of like the R&D beers are a hobby, but you still need to go to work every day to pay for the hobby. So that's kind of why we're doing what we're doing.
Okay. What would be yours and New Glarus' vision for the next 365 days?
Probably more the same. What we're doing for the balance of 2009 and 2010 will be to continue to improve our efficiencies. We built a new brewery, so we are continuing to figure out how to make great beer with less energy usage, less primary energy, be it natural gas or electricity, less waste, less labor. And that's sort of the watchword going in the future, because I think we're going to find that as soon as this current economic crisis starts to abate, that there's going to be probably more hyperinflation. So we're trying to make certain that we're set well for the future. And then secondly, tied to that is constantly improving our process, making our beer better and better every day that we come to work, to try to make the beer better. But as far as brands, we have not written our brand calendar for 2010. Let me back up a second. We make what's called a brand calendar in, say, October, and it lays out all of the beers that we're going to brew in the next year. And then we publish that to our wholesalers and our retailers so they know what to expect, because we make a lot of one-time beers, a lot of seasonal beers. So we try to make it as organized as possible. And we haven't written the 2010 a brand calendar yet. And in fact, if you go to our website, you can vote for which beers you think we should brew. There's beers that we've made in the past, people often ask for, or beers that you want us to brew that we haven't brewed. Like somebody wrote in and said, you guys should make a black IPA or whatever. And then we'll consider that for next year's brand calendar. But we do, our second R&D beer will be most likely be a lambic. In fact, it's right now in aging in oak barrels and slowly coming along. But that probably won't be ready till, you know, the year's end. I'm not 100% certain.
Yeah, that's a tough style to make from what I've learned.
Yeah, it is. It's very tough. You know, it's really funny because I firmly believe that the universe has a sense of humor because when you don't want a beer to taste like a lambic, you know, if a batch of beer spoils or something and it turns really, really sour or something, you know, it's like you don't want it to happen, it does that. But then when you want you know, lots of bread and lots of bacteria, they kind of are stubbornly resist you. So it's like growing weeds. It's easy to grow weeds, but it's hard to grow a garden. And I think lambics are difficult because you're working with so many microorganisms that are sort of like, you know, herding cats. They kind of go where they want, when they want. So we're not really in control. Still learning, I guess.
Is there any chance that New Glarus is going to be sent to new territories in the U.S.?
It's not in our plan, and it's not in our plan for a few reasons. One is that we believe that it's better to run like a river, run deep, than it is to run shallow and wide. When you see beers that maybe they sell 8,000 barrels of beer and they sell in 35 states, that's, in our opinion, that's very, very much a vulnerable situation. So we try real hard to be strong in our own neighborhood. You know, in the old days when breweries sold around their smokestack. Secondly, we really don't want to be a big brewery. We don't view barrelage as an end-all in itself. In other words, people pay attention to how many barrels a brewery is selling, but really what's important is how efficient are you at selling your beer, you know, how profitable is the company. And the farther you go afield, the more expensive it is to sell the beer, and you somewhat dilute your message. In other words, we're a Wisconsin brewery. We understand Wisconsin. We understand the market. It's easier for us to sell beer here. If we start selling beer around the country, we lose that intimacy with our customers, and we frankly don't, we're not experts in that field. To give you an example, we'll sell probably around 80,000 barrels of beer this year, and we have a sales department of two people. And if we were to sell farther afield, the amount of salespeople we would need would be much more, obviously, and the amount of beer we would sell would be much less. Because frankly, I have to scold your listeners here, because most modern beer consumers are tasters. And I don't have a problem with that, because it's reality, it's what it is. But there's no brand loyalty anymore. It used to be that your father and your grandfather, he drank Pabst, or he drank Miller or Stroh's, and that's all he drank.
Right.
In this day and age, you know, you take one bottle of this, one bottle of that, and you move on. And so you can't really, as a brewer, we can't really build a business based on that.
So, yeah, I'm not so sure the majority are tasters, but they're the most vocal.
True. That's a good point. That's a good point. I will concede that point. But, for us, we really, in the end, the thing is we really don't want to be a big brewery. We don't want to be hustling and, doing beer tastings all over the country. And we're brewers. We want to, we live in a little town and fly over country, and we're, happy in our little world. And we want to brew our beer and go home at night and not, we got enough fist fights as it is, and I love trying to sell. farther.
So. Cool. Very cool. Going back to having fun in the brewery, I've had a chance to have a handful of the Unplugged series, and I wanted to know, what was the most successful one that surprised you, and what was the one that didn't take too well to your core audience that surprised you?
Well, first of all, let me define our core audience. For the Unplugged, there's really, like you say, the vocal minority, you know, people that, you know, maybe you write on rootbeer.com or Beer Advocate, you know, that vocal beer aficionado group. And then there's kind of the more, you know, the average beer drinker. So they have different they have different expectations. And probably our most successful Unplugged that we made was our Apple Ale. And that was a very easy drinking beer, and that we sold a whole bunch of. In general, the Unplugs do pretty well. Another one that surprised me was we made a Berliner Weiss, and it was a lactic beer. You know, it was naturally fermented. We don't add, you know, acetone to sourness. We do a natural fermentation.
Right.
And that beer was, you know, it was a typical Berliner Weiss beer. And in my experience, people are kind of freaked when they taste sour beers. I've had that experience with people say, oh my God, this beer spoiled. Oh my God. You know, I did get one phone call from a guy that said, you know, dude, I love your beer, but I got to tell you, this Berliner Weiss is really sour. You know, just thought you should know. I said, well, it's supposed to taste
sour. I was like, well, you're welcome.
Yeah, right. But that beer was very well received by, in my opinion, we're successful when the beer aficionados, or, you know, beer geeks, and the Joe Sixpacks, when they both like a beer. To me, that's a home run. And that was the case with the Berliner Weiss. People really loved it. Now, we made a iced barley wine, and that was like 13.5% alcohol, and I don't know, I remember, it was like, you know, truly not just made up calculated numbers, but, you know, somewhere in the 80s, I think, for bitterness units, and the stuff was just like drinking sandpaper, and I think it's going to be some years before it comes into balance, so that beer was, you know, was not a big hit. I think it becomes obvious. When you make a good beer, it sells. When you don't, when it's a mediocre beer, it has mediocre sales. And I really found that to be true, that it's, in the end, the taste of the beer matters. And when you make a beer that's really good, people buy it. People repeat buy it. So, you know, we learn as we go.
All right. Well, I like to think of you and your team using a keeping it real philosophy. You know, you have Sam Adams with their Imperial series, and you have many of the medium to larger craft brewers, you know, trying to make something very bold, something very high in alcohol. And I look at your lineup with some really traditional recipes that maybe, you know, the last generation enjoyed, or something that's enjoyed over in Europe. And I want to know how you guys keep on keeping it real.
Yeah, thanks for noticing, because we really do make a conscious effort to go our own way. I know that sounds corny, but when people think of interesting beers, or how would you say, notable beers, or beers that develop a chatter on the internet, which is sort of kind of what the Unplugged series is all about, you think of Imperial or Double or 100 IBUs and, you know, the most extreme alcohol content, whatever. And I don't have a problem with that type of beer, because it's fun, and I like those kind of beers. But sometimes an extreme beer might be something that is not so big. It might be extreme because it's not commonly brewed. It might be extreme because it's really complex in flavor. Or it might be a style that's not typically brewed. Or it might be an invention. We might invent a beer that's, you know, that's a whole new style of beer, which also causes, it's a whole other subject, causes a lot of homebrewers great anxiety when you have a beer that doesn't fit into a style. I kind of laugh because it makes me really nervous. But to give you an example, we made, in our Unplugged series, our Extreme Beer series, we made a lowly Bohemian Pilsner. What we did was we bought some an older variety of under-modified malt from Moravia. We used 100% Saaz hops. We did a triple decoction. We fermented in unlined oak, and then we put it into stainless steel lager tank, and we croisened, and we aged it for like 60 days. So this beer came from, in the early 80s, before the wall came down, I went to the Czech Republic and took a really, you know, extensive tour of Pilsner Urquell, you know, back before people really went there. And I wrote down the way they make beer, and so now it's owned by SAB Miller,
right.
And, you know, it's changed. And so I made a beer that was my best attempt at to make what Pilsner Urquell tasted like in 1984 or 85 when I went there. So that was, to me, that was worthy of the Unplugged series, although it was only 12 degrees Play-Doh and, like, you know, 40 bitterness units and, you know, not particularly noteworthy, but it was a really nice Pilsner. And a lot of the, you know, beer aficionados say, you know, Pilsner, ho-hum. But it's my favorite beer style. And, you know, it's like a chef saying, pizza, yeah, whatever, you know. I want something more esoteric. So that, you know, that's kind of the whole idea. Like, to give you another example, in our normal series of beers, in a given year, like right now, we have our Unplugged Out that's a sour porter. It's based on the porters that were brewed in the 1870s in London. And I got the information on how to brew this beer from the writings of a guy by the name of Graham Wheeler out of England. You can Google him on the internet. He's wrote his opinion based on his research about what porters tasted like in London. And the Rodenbach, for example, is a sort of the son of that type of beer. So we made a porter that was very acetic, and that's, you know, really kind of, in my opinion, out in left field, and it tastes really nice to me if you like a sour beer. But the same week we made that beer, we made an American-style light lager. I mean, like Bud Miller Coors type beer.
Okay.
And that also causes people to be, to freak out, because they can't understand, they can't wrap their head around a brewery that will make a sour 150-year-old style porter and then turn around the next day and make an American style lager. I don't think there's really a brewery in the world that makes as large a range of beers in one brewery that we do. So I kind of get a kick out of rattling people's cages with, you know, changing what's accepted. Because microbreweries are expected to make certain styles of beers. You got to make a pale ale, you make a, you know, an IPA. If you're adventurous, you make a double IPA. Maybe you make a stout. And, you know, everybody does it. So, hey, I want to, you know, I like American style lagers. I'm going to brew one. I like it. Tastes good. People like it. People buy it. So why the hell not, you know?
And you might be re-educating somebody who doesn't know that much about those traditional styles as well.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, yeah. That's right. We want to keep people engaged and keep people not necessarily guessing, but expecting something like what the hell they're gonna throw at us now, and that keeps it kind of fun.
I would agree.
I'm a creative person. I'm not really. My wife's a business person. I'm not a business person. I'm a brewer. I'm just a simple brewer. I just like making beer.
What one style or recipe haven't you done yet that you are really dreaming up right now?
I really like Weiss beers. We have open fermenters that are made specifically for making wheat beers. So we make a whole range of wheat beers. And I'll probably continue to make different styles of wheat beer. We're experimenting with Brettanomyces, so there's a whole range of lambic style beers. I would never call them a lambic because I have respect for the whole idea of Appalachian. So it's not a lambic, but it's in the lambic style. So those are a whole family of beers that we can make. And I was also kind of contemplating some type of but maybe an IPA instead of a double IPA, maybe a half IPA. I don't know. I'm thinking about maybe making a beer that's instead of an IPA strength or double IPA strength, maybe like an IPA, but a little bit more easy drinking, more of a session beer. Okay, so then your listeners will say, well, hey, dumbass, that's a pale ale. But no, I'm thinking about
less malt,
tweaking things a little bit. Yeah, exactly. More aromatic. I don't know. Let's see what comes out of that.
What's kind of funny out here, a couple brewers have been doing this thing called the India Pale Lager. And I've tried it from the brewery and from Ballast Point, and it's, to say the least, it's interesting.
Is it notable, or is it just kind of like, yeah, that's interesting, ho-hum, let's move on?
Well, I really love the Ballast Point one, but again, because I'm here in the West Coast, it's the main thing for me is still the aromatics, as if it was an IPA.
Yeah, right.
But the mouthfeel is much lighter, and I think the malt's knocked down a bit.
And you think that's bad?
No, I never experienced it before, and I'm wondering if those are the kind of ideas that sometimes you dream up.
Well, I'm thinking that, I'm thinking about the idea of a beer, a session beer. In other words, if you think of a really intensely aromatic beer that's like a double IPA that has lots of a mixture of maybe it's dry hopped more than once with, really pungent American types of hops, but instead of being 6, 7, or 8, or 9% alcohol, maybe it's 5% alcohol.
Right.
But I do think it needs to have, obviously, if you're going to be, relatively bitter, you're going to need to have some malt backbone. And maybe not with caramel malt, maybe with some Maris Otter or something, I don't know. I haven't brewed it yet. I probably shouldn't even be saying this because this is my little secret project, so now the whole world knows. But
busted.
Yeah, right. But that's kind of what I'm kicking around.
That sounds pretty cool.
So in other words, it's like we made a beer called Cracked Wheat. It's a blend of a Bavarian Hefeweizen with American style pale ale. So this beer would be say a cross between like an IPA and a like you said a Pilsner or an IPA and a golden ale, something like that.
Well, I want your input on a segment of the craft brewing industry. I'm going to name you three completely different craft brewers that have made it big. Boston Beer, Sierra Nevada, Dogfish Head.
Okay.
I already know, I was originally going to ask you which brewery do you aspire to be most like, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say you don't. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on, I guess, the success of those three right now in the craft brewing industry and how it ties into what you guys do.
Well, I would say that all three of those breweries are very different, and they've gone about, their success has come about in different ways. But obviously all three of them make world-class beers, and they're successful because the beer is good, and different models. But I guess I would say our model is most closely related to Sierra Nevada, because Sierra Nevada I would describe as a closely held family brewery that is puts quality first and spends its capital on continuous improvement and improvements in process. And quality is always first, and all decisions are based on that before anything. So So I would say that, not that I would never say that the other two breweries don't have those same ethos, but I sense it very strongly from Ken Grossman. So I have a lot of respect for, like most brewers, I have a lot of respect for all three, but I probably aspire to be more like Ken Grossman's structure than anybody.
All right. About a month or two ago, we held a poll on our website for the best Midwest craft brewer. And in the name of fun, no, there was no prizes handed out, or at least not yet anyway. But what we noticed were the Midwest craft beer fans that participated in this poll were just insane, just completely nuts, and ran laps around just about every other group of regional fans that we've dealt with yet. And I want to know if you'd be able to explain why that area of the country is so crazy about craft beer compared to the rest of the country.
I could venture a guess, but I'll tell you, and it's only just my opinion because I'm not an expert, I'm not a sociologist, but I can tell you that the Midwest is a large area, so you can't say it, you know, as one place. For example, San Diego is very different than San Francisco, for example. And, you know, the upper Midwest is very different than, say, Missouri. But I grew up in the city of San Francisco. And so I'm born and raised Californian.
Cool.
And I'm looking at Wisconsin through an outsider's eyes. And I can tell you that people on the West Coast, and I'd imagine also on the East Coast, there is, and I can say this because I'm from San Francisco, so I remember that, there's a level of egocentricity and arrogance. If, you know, someone was to say, where's Wisconsin, they probably couldn't find it on a map. In other words, we're in flyover country. And I always tease because I imagine that people in California think that Midwesterners are a little bit thick, kind of hickish. But actually, if I speak about Wisconsin, Wisconsin has been a very progressive state for a long time. In fact, Milwaukee used to have a socialist mayor. So people in Wisconsin are very progressive, both politically. Okay, we did have McCarthy here, but in general, Wisconsin is a very progressive state. It's very well educated. It's very parochial in its buying habits. In other words, it prefers to buy local. It's a manufacturing base. It's not prone to extremes. Midwesterners, the ethic of the Northern Europeans is one of kind of steady and slow, slow to make decisions. So they're not prone to follow fads or knee-jerk reactions. Don't forget, Wisconsin is a blue state, too. And I think that people are very proud of what's made here. And there is a lot of great beers in the Midwest, but we don't have the internet chatter clout of the West Coast. And I think that's what Midwestern beer drinkers are probably responding to, because every time you open up a trade magazine or read something internet, it's about a brewery on the coast. And, you know, unfortunately, in the world of information, it's all about the press release. The days of Walter Cronkite and the days of research and people going out in the field and looking are gone, and everything is done by press releases. So we don't have the clout as the coasts do. And I think that the customers sense that. So they kind of become more vocal. It's like a Green Bay Packer fan.
That's so true.
I guess that's at least my humble opinion.
Well, I got one last question for you, Dan, before we wrap this up. And it might be a tough one or it might not. What is your favorite non-New Glarus beer and why?
You know, I like so many different beers, but I guess if I was, you know, like Desert Island beers, I really like Schneider Weiss, and I really like Rodenbach Grand Cru. If I can only have two beers, that's probably what I would drink.
Fair enough.
But there's so many, you know. So many. It's like, what's your favorite song, you know?
Right. Well, I appreciate your time, Dan, and I'm glad you could join us, and we hope to have you back again. We always have questions for you, and I was able to review a good handful of your beers, and according to our traffic and our demographics, people were really receptive to it.
Cool. Well, I'm glad that you included me, and I had a lot of fun talking to you, so thanks a lot.